This is Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. I analyze the news on social media at Jessica Yellen. I covered the White House for CNN and ABC, and I am very excited to be your guest host for the next few weeks here in my hometown of Los Angeles. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the last week of April, and this week, the news that the world's richest man is positioned to buy Twitter for $44 billion sent the Twitterverse into a tailspin. What does Elon Musk plan to do if he takes over the influential site? He claims he wants to promote free speech and make the platform more transparent. But will he? And what would that look like? And why in the world is a social networking service worth $44 billion? Let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me on.
So Musk has made a lot of pronouncements and promises. Some are pretty eye-opening, and there's even now, a bit of doubt about whether the deal will ultimately go through, but let's just assume it does for now. Liz, what's your reaction to the news that Musk is poised to become the new master of Twitter?
You know, amusement, I suppose. I don't feel any immediate dread or panic. I think a lot of that is premature. You know, for my official reaction, it's something along the lines of it's possible that Elon Musk could be troublesome for Twitter. I sort of doubt it. It doesn't seem like he would necessarily be involved in day-to-day operations. I don't think he's going to be a mod on Twitter. it just doesn't seem likely. And he doesn't seem like he's participated in this sort of, you know, direct micromanaging of, you know, those kinds of projects before. And so my suspicion would be, you know, not too terribly much changes. Second, to the degree that Elon Musk would have outsized power over the public sphere because Twitter is the public sphere, yes, that's an indictment of Elon Musk. It's just an even larger indictment of everything else. Twitter should not have the hold it has on American life. If we're admitting to ourselves that Twitter is this critical element of American politics, I mean, I'm not sure that's true. And it, to the degree that it is, it shouldn't be. And I hope to God it's not. And I wish it wasn't, because it's a horrible platform with perverse incentives. I enjoy it a lot. But, you know, I mean, journalists are, you know, unusual people. So, I mean, yeah.
I think that's a much more measured take than we hear from a lot on the left, and super interesting. I want to get back to your assessment that it's not really the public square later in the conversation. Tim, first, your reaction to the news that Musk is buying Twitter.
I think it will make Twitter better. I think one of the big problems is that we know that the way I've always described Twitter, Facebook's rules, are that they're not rules at all. It's like old vagrancy laws. This is what cops use to bust the people they know are the bad guys. This happened in my college where, you know, one of the good students got caught with pot and it was a slap on the wrist and a warning. And one of the kids who everybody hated got caught with pot and they got kicked out. And that's what the sort of, oh, well, you can't use hacked materials or this is harassment. We conservatives always knew that these were enforced overwhelmingly against conservatives, and that in the 2020 election, the rules were used to cover up stories that reflected poorly on Joe Biden. And the fact that a Babylon Bee joke will get them kicked off of Twitter was a pretty chilling sign that if we disagree from where the culture war is headed, that we're going to get branded as hate speech or something like that. All that said, If what he did the day he took over was delete twitter.com from the world,
please,
that would
please,
make the
please.
World and my life so much better. I'd probably ignore
so
my
good.
Kids less. I'd probably, you know, write better articles. We can save that for later. I think that if you consider Twitter to be possibly good, Musk taking over is probably an improvement.
That would be amazing. A $44 billion delete button.
please.
For anyone who doesn't know, the Babylon Bee is a satirical publication that leans right and was taken down briefly off Twitter because they violated their speech standards. And on that, Tim, let's get a little specific for a moment, because Twitter's rules currently also bar using the service to spread medical misinformation, to spread synthetic or manipulated media like deep fakes, or to impersonate someone. Would you want to see those rules lifted?
So, I mean, in the abstract, a lot of these rules seem like a good idea. But medical misinformation, if I had said when the vaccines first came out, hey, the vaccines won't do a great job of stopping the spread of COVID, that would have been called medical misinformation, even though months later what we found out was the vaccines do a great job of keeping you from dying with it, and they do an okay job of stopping the spread of COVID. Other things that have been branded misinformation included the idea that maybe this virus leaked out of a lab. That's still a big maybe, but saying maybe, you know, 2 years ago got it branded. But that said, that I'm not being nihilistic to say there can't be rules. I want there to be no porn, right? I would want Twitter and Facebook to keep out, to have even stricter rules on there, because that's the kind of conservative I am. I think that that stuff is bad for people. And if I ran a website, I would keep it out of people's eyesight. But I also agree that it's not entirely 100% crystal clear what that is. This is a really hard job. I don't think Elon Musk thinks that moderating content across 190-something countries and every sort of ideology is going to be easy. But I don't think liberals should assume that, oh, disinformation, medical stuff, trying to, you know, election-related misinformation, that those are easy questions and we should just keep them off. It's all really complicated. Our objection has been it's been enforced in such a way that disproportionately hurt conservatives because of the ideology of the people behind Twitter, and that seemed at times specifically aimed to help Democrats.
Liz, a lot of people on the left think would disagree with that, and they're mostly concerned about the rules on Twitter that say you can't display logos of hate groups or dehumanizing a group of people based on characteristics including race, gender, religion, sexuality. If that standard is gone, if those kinds of comments are allowed back in, do you think people on the left leave Twitter en masse?
I mean, I'm against almost everything that has been mentioned here. I wish there was no porn on Twitter. I wish there was no medical misinformation on Twitter. I wish people didn't harass each other on Twitter. And nevertheless, having been on the internet, having grown up on the internet, I'm 31. I don't really remember my life before being online and being in forums or eventually social media websites like Twitter, which is just kind of an evolution of early internet forum culture. I always remember there being rules against these various types of speech that cause problems, and I always remember the rules being completely ineffective and applied kind of haphazardly, just because of course they would be, because you're dealing with a tidal wave of content and there is just no possible way to moderate it. So any space you're on online, there's going to be porn in it. You can't keep it out. Any space you're on online, there's going to be harassment. You just can't stop it. You can't stop what's coming. You're dealing with a side of human nature and a space that is enables it to such a degree that ultimately what we need to be talking about is like coping solutions, I think. And that's just my sort of nihilistic view from having been on Twitter, you know, a really long time at this point and through my formative years. So for instance, harassment is already banned on Twitter. As a female journalist, I mean, I have a guy recently who DM'd on Twitter one of my in real life friends who is not a public person at all. She is not a journalist. She's not involved in politics. She's just a friend of mine. This individual sent her a direct message to ask her if she's having sex with me.
Wow.
You know, but that's just, and it sucks. I don't like it. I hate it. But that occurs to me, and that kind of thing occurs to me when we have all of these conversations about a messianic figure who can fix Twitter and make sure everything's fair and only bad people get banned and good people don't get banned and everyone has a freedom of speech protected and yada, yada. It's just like, no, it's a cesspit. It's a cesspit because it's out of control and there's no way to get it under control. A better question is, should anyone be on here at all? Or should we be really vastly reconsidering what we're doing to ourselves on here?
Maybe someone should start a new app called Canada and everyone can literally move their accounts to Canada.
starting a new app called Only Talking to My Friends in Real Life.
Right. Oh, that one's amazing. Revolutionary. So quickly to both of you, Musk says he plans to get rid of bots, authenticate users, and crucially, add an edit button. Where do you stand on this pressing issue? Tim, are you for or against an edit button?
I don't know about edit button. The authentication stuff gets at the question of anonymity. And here's a place where I realize I'm weird. And by the way, all of us being on Twitter is a sign of us being weird because we're journalists. And as a journalist, I'm somebody who has public opinions. I share my opinion in public. That's what I'm paid to do. And then I realize a lot of my neighbors, they might be a banker or a barber, and they have opinions, and they want to share it anonymously. I'm always bugged by anonymity because it seems that all the most foul people harassing me on Twitter or through email are doing it anonymously. And I've always thought maybe things will get better if everybody puts their name behind behind what they're saying. But I also know that America was, you know, partly started through the Federalist Papers through anonymity. So that's a really thorny issue. I see the arguments on both sides. I hate anonymous trolls, but I would hate to think that nobody's allowed to express an opinion without sort of parading their name in front of the whole internet.
Tim, you know, Tucker Carlson is back on the platform now. So is Fox News host Mark Levin. One of the big questions is, if Musk does take over, will he let former President Trump back on? First, do you think he should? And second, do you think Trump 2022 would have the same influence on Twitter that he had in, say, 2019?
I think they should let him on, and I think that that would make a challenge to the Republican Party of, hey, guys, stop waiting for somebody else to take care of your problem here. You guys have to grow a pair and go out and defeat Trump and take your party back from him.
Liz, essential to this conversation is something you raised, which is this perhaps false assumption that Twitter really matters in our politics, in our discourse as a public square. A 2019 study by Pew found that only 22% of U.S. adults use Twitter, and they are more educated, higher income, and tend to lean Democrat. So what does Twitter really reflect?
I think Twitter reflects a lot of things. I mean, Twitter is very, 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 very important to journalists, and journalists are very active on Twitter. We know it doesn't actually generate traffic. So this isn't where journalists are introducing people to their work, really, or even attracting people to it. It's sort of where journalists are telling each other what is important to write about at the moment and sort of having these conversations with each other that are developing the structure of the news narrative, more or less, because this is where assignment editors hang out and start thinking about what pieces to assign out to freelancers and so on. The problem is that sort of everyone can watch this happening in real time. So, you know, you have antagonistic political parties out there who are observing journalists talking to each other rather freely. And then they just, you know, for instance, Tucker Carlson can just report on what they're saying to each other on Twitter. And you know, you have a very, at that point, kind of destabilizing, delegitimizing, I think, situation where, you know, these institutions are supposed to be understood to be objective and neutral. Actually, now that you can see people in kind of a space that's not clearly private or public going into opinions that might be personal or professional, you know, you start to develop these, I think, major antagonisms towards, I think, you know, the press and so forth. I think Twitter's played a role in that.
I'll say that one of my pet peeves, having worked in cable news, is that it models conflict and disagreement as the only form of political conversation, that outrage is the way to show that you care. And Twitter also favors outrage and extremism. It also elevates non-experts, and this is the technical term, blowhards. The stats show that 10% of the users generate 80% of the tweets, and I do think that's corrosive to how we think about government and politics and this public square, and it would be helpful to change that. At the same time, Musk just tweeted, "Let's make Twitter maximum fun, and next I'm buying Coca-Cola to put the cocaine back in." So
all right.
Maybe he's just trolling us. I'll be back with Liz Brunig and Tim Carney to talk about the direction of social media. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise and former chief White House correspondent for CNN. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Let's broaden out this conversation about Twitter to think of the impact of social media in general. For that, I'm bringing in a special guest who has put a lot of thought into this question, Jonathan Haidt. He is a social psychologist at the New York University Stern School of Business. He has a fascinating article in The Atlantic this month entitled, "Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid." Thank you for joining us, Jonathan Haidt.
My pleasure, Jessica.
So you make the case in this piece that the polarization, rage, and divisiveness in our culture right now was not inevitable, but the die was cast in 2009 when Facebook came on the scene because Facebook made virality the key to success on the internet. Certain kinds of posts got shared the most. It amplified certain kinds of voices and behaviors, which has proceeded to make us more petty, dumb, and divided. Would you explain the link between virality and our current polarized dysfunction?
Certainly. So it's funny that you quoted Elon Musk saying, "Let's make Twitter maximum fun," because a lot of us remember when at the beginning, you know, Twitter was generally a fun, nice place, and Facebook was a fun, nice place, and back in the '90s, the internet was mostly a fun, nice place. I mean, there were chat rooms and places that were nasty, but there was an incredible sense of possibility and optimism and discovery. And now in the 2010s, it's just a hellscape of nastiness with pockets of niceness. What happened? And what I argue in this piece, so I'm a social psychologist, and I say, don't just focus on the content. Don't just focus on the information or the disinformation. Focus on the social relationships. How did it change the incentives of people? And so what changed, I argue, is that in 2009, when Facebook added the like button and Twitter copied it, Twitter added the retweet button, Facebook copied it, they now had huge amounts of information to algorithmicize. So everything becomes much more engaging. But as you said before, engagement, it turns out, is best when you make people angry. And then add in the fact that you get prestige. But not everybody wants that prestige. What I argued in the piece is that Facebook and Twitter, they didn't give a voice to everybody. It was really only four groups that picked it up and used it to great effect. And that is the far right, the far left, trolls, and Russian agents. Those four. And now it's no fun. And people are afraid. People are afraid to speak up because those four groups will attack them and shame them.
Now, you say all of this has taken us in a dangerous direction and we're living in the modern equivalent of a Tower of Babel. What do you mean by that?
So the Tower of Babel story is a fascinating story. Most of us remember, oh yeah, you know, people built a tower and then God knocked it over because he was mad at them or something like that. But when you look at the actual story in Genesis, the key line is God says, "Let us go down and confound their language so that they may not understand each other." Now, I've spent most of my career looking at political polarization and left versus right and how we evolved to do intergroup conflict and war. But the Babel story is not about war. It's not about left versus right. It's about the fragmentation of everything. And that's what it feels like happened in the 2010s. So, you know, Fox News and cable TV, we got a sort of a nastier environment beginning in the 90s, talk radio. That spread anger, but it didn't make people fear each other. It didn't make ordinary citizens attack each other or be afraid to speak up. That only happened after around 2012, 2013. It's at that point that Twitter becomes and Twitter especially, becomes a very effective platform to publicly shame or, quote, call out, end quote, anyone. That's when the world changed. And it changed in ways that make it, I think, not possible to have a democracy. A democracy is ruled by the people. The people are subject to passions. And I think Twitter brings out the worst passions, exactly the passions that the founding fathers feared.
Just to challenge you a bit, you write that there is a direction to history and it's toward cooperation at larger scales. But then enter social media, it dissolved the trust we need to cooperate. It's what you're talking about. It encouraged dishonesty, mob dynamics, etc. But only social media? Doesn't our education system, news deserts, growing wealth inequality, I don't know, a pattern of national leaders betraying our trust? Didn't all of that have something to do with our current dysfunction? Is the Facebook share button responsible for January 6th?
So all of those trends predate social media, and all of those trends were sort of going on. And there was a large and abnormal surge in trust after World War II. Being attacked by a foreign power and then fighting a four-year struggle for existence is a pretty darn good way to bring people together. So the post-war world was unusually cohesive. And that does begin to fall apart after the Vietnam War and Watergate. So in the 70s, there's a big drop. So all of that is ongoing. But then it falls off a cliff in the 2010s. And there's a qualitative change. That's what I'm arguing. As a professor, you know, we weren't afraid of our students in 2010 or 2012. And now many of us are. Most of them are lovely. But even if it's only 3% that love to report and shame anyone, well, if you've got one or two of them in the class, you have to be so careful what you say. It's not fun anymore. And that, I think, is what's happened. There used to be jokes. There used to be humor. There used to be basically decent people giving each other the benefit of the doubt. And I think this explosive viral social media, I use the metaphor that it's like everyone gets a dart gun. It's no fun when anybody can shoot a dart at you.
You say this is just the beginning. Why do you believe AI will make it worse?
Because part of what's going on, so I tend not to focus on the disinformation. That's a big topic, but it's one that almost everybody talks about. I mostly focus on the social dynamics, but the disinformation is important because it's not just, oh, you know, we might be deceived by a lie. It's the sheer quantity. And Jonathan Rauch, in his book, The Constitution of Knowledge, has been brilliant on this. He talks about the Russian disinformation tactic of the fire hose of falsehood. And when, you know, when Trump just says lie after lie, and most of his statements were untrue, literally the majority of things he said were untrue, according to fact checkers, at least. At a certain point, we get so disoriented, we give up. Most people give up. And that, I think, is what's happened. People are exhausted. Most people are decent, moderate, intelligent, but they're exhausted and disoriented. And so AI, you know, it's bad enough when bad agents can make up all kinds of stuff and put it out there. But AI is now so good that if you can do this yourself, go to GPT-3 and you can have it write a story for you. There are various apps that use this current version of AI that's publicly available. And so in a few years, certainly in time for the 2024 election, anyone can generate thousands, millions of fake videos, fake stories. You could generate a whole fake newspaper if you wanted. And this can all be done by AI. So the amount of, well, you know, as Steve Bannon said, the way to deal with the Democrats or the press was flood the zone with shit. But the amount of shit we're all swimming through now is nothing compared to what it's going to be in 2 or 3 years.
Before I bring the panel back in, I just want to ask you, could you briefly outline some of the specific reforms you support, which you think can improve social media?
Yes. So if my analysis is right, that social media is a solvent dissolving democratic norms and institutions, then there are three reform imperatives. The first is we have to harden our democratic institutions and our knowledge-generating institutions, such as universities and journalism, so that they can still function even when there's far more hatred and even violence. I do expect there'll be a lot more political violence in the coming years, given the current trends. So how do we have elections? How do we have a Supreme Court that people trust when everything is a political game? So I think we need, for example, 18-year terms in the Supreme Court, take out the gamesmanship in appointments. Open primaries is the biggest single thing we could do, not because they would necessarily elect more moderates, but because Congress people right now don't care what their constituents think. Their constituents don't matter unless they vote in their primary, which is just the extremists. So there's a bunch of reforms for political institutions. The second bucket is we have to make social media less toxic. And here, actually, you know, Elon Musk has been making some noises that he might do some of that. And that the most important thing we can do is user authentication. That doesn't mean people have to post under their real name. This is very important. People seem to think, and I think, Tim, I liked his comments very much, but I think he seemed to think that user authentication means you have to post with your real name. It doesn't. It just means that a Russian agent can't open 100 accounts. You have to actually show that you're a person in a particular country and you're old enough, and then you can post under whatever name you want.
I want to bring our panel back in. There was a lot you laid out there. Tim, first to you, what's your reaction to Jonathan's thesis?
I do think it is acting as a solvent. I definitely agree with that. As a conservative, I'm naturally skeptical of his proposed solutions that we can pass reforms that'll work, just not because they're bad ideas, but just because reforms often tend to backfire. But the main thing I was thinking about while you were talking, John, was kids. I mean, I've got a lot of kids. I teach, I coach youth, and I think that while Twitter is probably is definitely bad for me, I think it's downright poisonous for children. And I would think if we were going to reform anything, every school district in America should start by saying you're not allowed to bring a smartphone into the school or something like that. We've got to really worry about how this is affecting children. And I just wonder if you have thoughts either on reforms on that or on how it am I wrong that it's disproportionately harming children?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for this opening. This is my favorite topic because this is the place where there was complete bipartisan agreement and the stakes couldn't be higher. So there's an epidemic of depression and anxiety that hit American kids in 2013. Wasn't there in 2010. As soon as they get on social media, as soon as they get, especially the girls on Instagram, the very next year, 2013, rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide rise rapidly. They've doubled for young teens, doubled, 100% increase in suicide for preteens and young teens. And the evidence is increasingly clear that it is caused by the sudden switch, the transformation of childhood, so that kids don't play anymore, even in school. Yeah, I go visit my son's middle school. At lunch, the kids aren't playing. They're sitting around on their phones. So it has been a complete disaster for teen mental health. And that's one of the most important things we can do is raise the age to 16 and enforce it. Right now it's 13 and it's not enforced.
Liz, I want to bring you in here. John said that, you know, since the advent of social media, it's gotten less fun, but it's also brought in many more voices and a lot of diversity, and we have many more perspectives. So has it been an entirely bad thing?
I mean, I remember being on the internet when I was very young, as stated. People were having a lot of fun. It was a lot of adults having sexual interactions with children, like constantly. This was like the, I think maybe a core component of Tumblr was adults having sexual conversations and just sexual interactions, generally role-playing, trading nudes, sexting, having phone sex, etc., planning to meet up for sex with teenagers and adolescents. This was just because everything was so completely unregulated. This was going on Facebook. I mean, just across the board, MySpace. It was a lot of bullying of one another. I mean, there was a great Rolling Stone piece on one of these MySpace queens and her, you know, excessive bullying of other MySpace kids that then led to her sort of being hunted and stalked in real life. But I mean, this was a big deal when I was in high school anyway, were these incredibly vicious online campaigns of teens against one another. You know, I think it's gotten a lot less fun if you're a journalist, but the internet was always quite bad. And, you know, it continues to be a place of just, I think, kind of unmitigated human expression. And so you're going to get pretty much the full span of human desire and emotion and will. And that's a lot to take in.
Well, I'll share my experience a little. I now do the news on social media. I spend my whole day there. And I did it because I thought it would be a way to reach people who are turned off by traditional media, traditional news. And in that regard, it's great. You know, you can build a relationship of trust. It's direct. You're countering disinformation where they're getting it. And all day long, I'm answering DMs from the audience asking, what do sanctions mean? What is this thing? Or is this true? That's the good. The bad I'm seeing is, A, you're entirely dependent on the algorithms and the revenue strategies of these companies over which you have no control. But I'm also noticing people are extremely aggravated. Their tolerance for frustration and disagreement is exponentially lower now than it was even 2 years ago. They are also convinced that the way to show they care is outrage. They're always at a 10 or often at a 10 when they're upset about something. And they're so skeptical of sources. This is what's most troubling to me. They believe that it's almost as though everyone's been trained to disbelieve and look for fake news and conspiracy theories and politicized information, but they don't have the tools to discern what to believe. And I think it's in part because these platforms elevate blowhards and don't elevate expertise. And we need some environments in which experts are valued. I personally think these platforms should be regulated as utilities, but
I think it's a much bigger, broader, and I mean, I guess this would be my only point of disagreement with John Haidt's article, is, you know, I think this is what's going on with social media is a reflection of a much bigger problem that it goes much further back in time, right? We're having a legitimation crisis. This is just liquid modernity. All that's solid melts into air, right? This is something that's been happening for more than 100 years at this point, which is people losing trust in institutions and authority. They don't trust governments anymore. They don't trust the press. They don't trust pretty much anything they're told. They make decisions about who and what to trust based on gut feelings and personal relationships, which are completely legitimate ways, to decide who to trust, right? I mean, when you're thinking about making decisions on an individual level, it's just that it's a complex society and we have to make decisions on a mass level in a democracy. And so the legitimation crisis is a really big problem. The other issue with the legitimation crisis is long after people lose trust in institutions, those institutions still govern them. So people find themselves having zero trust in the press, but still having to go to us for information. And they hate it. They resent it. And they resent us. And like you say, just because they know they can't trust us, they feel they can't trust us, doesn't mean they have a good and clear sense of where they can find the truth, which is also a sort of benighted and frustrating situation to be in.
That's true. I'm finding people mistrust the press as an institution, but trust individual reporters. That's one thesis.
You can build trust with individuals. Yeah.
John, I want to give you the last word here.
Sure. So I understand what Liz is saying, the decline in trust is longstanding. But the key idea in my article is what I call structural stupidity. It's not that people are stupid. It's that you get institutions like, say, university, where all of a sudden people are afraid to dissent, they're afraid to challenge something. So what comes out is the orthodox view. And we've seen the same in newspapers. The New York Times is full of great reporters. I've spoken to many of them, and they say beginning around 2018, if you challenge the consensus, you challenge the dominant view, especially on race, gender, or trans, you would be so slaughtered within the company or in public. So the New York Times, I think, became less reliable. At least many conservatives perceived it to have been. Okay, and do you agree that something has changed, or do you think that there's no intimidation within the paper?
No, what happened with in my experience, at least, was precisely a legitimation crisis. They would say to you, we'll protect you, you know, if you write something that's controversial or that Twitter gets mad about. And I just knew for a fact that they couldn't do it, right? Because you don't know what's going to happen with Twitter. And I thought to myself, I feel bad for them because they can't really say with full confidence what they can do because they're very responsive to Twitter.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't know what Twitter's going to do. And so those institutions are, you just can't trust them. And so you have to make calculations about how to defend yourself as a brand, as opposed to, you know, kind of hunkering down as a member of a team and saying, I'll put my life in, I commend myself into the hands of my business. And so, that's the continued dissolution of and atomization of everything.
But that also, what you're describing is another mechanism by which intimidation and fear causes a newspaper to lose the very valuable processes of competing views and editors and fact checkers and give and take and talk to both sides. Those are the things that help a newspaper, which is staffed by normal, flawed individuals, produce something that's better than any one individual could do. And Twitter in particular has made people afraid. And that's what causes, I believe, the breakdown of organizations and institutions that have lost their viewpoint diversity and that develop an orthodoxy.
And yet we all spend time on Twitter.
We're trapped.
Well, I speak for myself.
I'll keep drinking that garbage.
I want to thank everyone, Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist at New York University Stern School of Business and author of the Atlantic article, Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. What fun.
I've been talking with Elizabeth Brunig and Tim Kearney. We'll be back with a January 6th investigation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right is Tim Kearney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. This week was not a great week for Republicans who were in Congress or at the Capitol on January 6th. Leaked audio tapes show that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy thought President Trump should resign after a mob of his supporters assaulted the Capitol. He said that in a phone call with Representative Steve Scalise days after the Capitol attack. In another call, he said he hoped some of his colleagues would be kicked off Twitter, contradicting some of his later public statements. When reporters broke this story, McCarthy said he never had those conversations, and then the tapes leaked showing he did. Tim, what is happening?
I'm more impressed with Kevin McCarthy this week than I ever have been. What he said just after January 6th to his party was the greatest signs of political insight and courage I've seen from him. I was, you know, if that's all we knew about what Kevin McCarthy said about January 6th, I would say absolutely make this guy be speaker. But obviously what he was saying in private, he later punished other Republicans for saying in public. And so now he's getting the pincer from both the pro-Trump people. You know, you got Congressman Gates calling McCarthy an anti-Trump weenie, and then from people who are criticizing Trump, pointing out that he was a coward in the face of Trump and the Trump-supporting Republican electorate. So I'm not going to predict what's going to happen in the speaker election. I stopped predicting elections after Donald Trump became the Republican nominee. But I am going to say that he certainly is feeling the pressure from both sides. And but I have no idea which way the Republican Party is going to go, because they can't win with Trump and you can't survive in that party if you're against Trump.
Let me just push you on the politics a little bit. So for context, House Republicans met Wednesday and McCarthy appeared to have the backing of most of his colleagues. As you noted, there were some who aren't supportive, but most seem to agree that winning back the majority is the priority, not taking on McCarthy. If he becomes speaker, does that mean the leader of a party can be caught bald-faced lying about something as consequential as January 6th, and it just doesn't matter? Do people in Washington not care about honesty anymore?
Bill Clinton perjured himself and was the rock star of the Democratic Party for another 15 years. This town doesn't care about honesty. If you win, and Kevin McCarthy is above all a political operative. He has lots of friends, and he is seen as good at helping people win elections. And if he pulls off those roles, while if I were in the party, I'd say, okay, make him, you know, in charge of the congressional, you know, getting people elected rather than the speaker. I think he would be rewarded with the speakership if people think they helped him win elections. It's exactly what the Democrats did when they said Bill Clinton is our guy who wins, and they stayed with him even though he was a known perjurer who had to get disbarred for perjuring himself about a sexual affair with an intern half his age.
About sex, not about overthrowing the system we rely on to determine our next leader.
I mean, a president lying under oath is a bad thing, and it proves that he would lie at any time. I mean, we've been in this show tracing things back to their roots. We could go way back. We could talk about Nixon, et cetera, whatever you want. But for somebody my age, Bill Clinton showed that total dishonesty and depraved lying will not only make it not stop you from winning elections, you can still be a hero of a large part of the media and one of the parties. So Kevin McCarthy, if he becomes speaker, would not surprise me at all.
Liz, McCarthy's being caught in a lie. It's pretty egregious. And yet he's on a glide path to controlling the House if Republicans take control in November. So why haven't Democrats been able to use January 6th and this obvious hypocrisy to rally public opinion against Republican leadership?
I think they waited too long in the process, you know, for something to pop. So they've been doing the January 6th thing since January 6th. People have lost interest. They possibly did find something good at this point, but this is like chapter 235 of the January 6th trials. I think the public has just moved on. So many things have happened since then, the Ukraine stuff at all. I just don't know that the public is really following along, and they probably have other concerns like inflation and so forth.
Well, does it concern you if this is accepted? Are we so cynical that we think it's normal and okay for our leaders to lie like this?
Oh, I mean, as Tim points out, it's not exactly the first time. I mean, and as I discussed earlier, you know, we're in the midst of like a full-on legitimation crisis. I don't think there's anyone in America, if you sat them down and said, do you think that politicians are generally telling you the truth, who would say yes? I think politicians are so widely understood at this point to be, you know, just sort of ridiculous figures who go on Twitter and say stupid things or make dumb videos of themselves or, you know, yell and scream in Congress and, you know, are constantly riding on Epstein's plane or doing sleazy and disgusting stuff.
Wow, that's a bleak portrait.
Yeah, I think that, but it, I mean, that feels like...
I mean, that's some, that's not all.
But it seems like the American public, compared to maybe the level of shock and outrage we were at with Clinton, which was, you know, a lot lower than where we were at with Nixon, it seems like we've now reached a pretty high level of tolerance.
Tim, this week we also learned that Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene texted White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, encouraging him to declare martial law to overturn the election. She said some Republican members of Congress supported that, too. So it looks like the January 6th investigation has been gathering information about suggestions that Trump's administration use these kinds of emergency powers. Do you feel like that's an important new turn for the investigation, and does any of this matter?
Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene has always been evidently insane and possibly dangerous. And I always think sometimes when I see these crazy things that happen on January 6th, thank God there were some kind of sane people there in the White House that held Trump back from doing even worse. And I talked earlier about sort of spinal fortitude that the Republicans need. And Kevin McCarthy ought to make sure that Marjorie Taylor Greene is gone. And, you know, hoping that some 14th Amendment case gets her kicked off the ballot is a cowardly way to do it. And he ought to stand up and, you know, that'll trigger Matt Gaetz. And then you've got to do battle with Matt Gaetz. The Republicans really have to clean house. And letting somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene hang around isn't just giving fodder to the liberal media that wants to attack Republicans. It's actually countenancing something evil and bad and dishonest. And that's where I'd hope McCarthy would show the honesty and forthrightness he had for a few hours in January 2021.
Tim, would you explain, tease that out a bit more, how would that work? Right now, it looks like somebody's dumping dirt on Representative Madison Cawthorn, presumably to push him out of the party. Are we talking about a campaign to make the politics untenable for Marjorie Taylor Greene, or you're saying—
Yeah, explicitly recruiting and raising funds for an opponent, and that putting the power of the party now— because of the legitimacy crisis that Liz is talking about, maybe that would help her. I don't know. But putting the power of the party behind somebody to remove them. They basically did that to remove Steve King in Iowa after his, you know, flirtations with white nationalists. And they ought to do it with a lot more people. I'm usually not one for cleaning house, but usually the Republican Party doesn't have as many wretched people as it does right now.
Are there others you'd put on that list?
Again, if you stand up for Marjorie Taylor Greene and say that you're with her, then maybe you have to join that too. I mean, again, Matt Gaetz is a guy I've met who seems really intelligent, and so that makes it seem to me extra cynical that he seems to have joined this side.
Liz, let's talk about the committee, this January 6th committee. They effectively have a November deadline, don't they? They have to deliver their results before the House, we predict, changes to Republican control. Do you expect it to be shut down instantly if they take over? And what do you think the Democrats need to deliver on this committee for it to make a difference?
Yeah, I expect it to be shut down almost instantly. The House Republicans are pretty rowdy, and I imagine they're going to be especially so after this midterm sweep. And so I wouldn't look for it to go on too long as a consolation prize or gesture towards bipartisanship or anything. I don't think you're going to see too much of that. In terms of, you know, what should they deliver for it to be worthwhile? I mean, you know, they found some information that seems to have confirmed for them what they needed to confirm, which was that there were right-wing figures and politicians who maybe knew that there was going to be some kind of gathering or protest with these people at the White House. And the Trump administration encouraged it, or at least, you know, didn't adequately discourage it. I think they've put that out there. It's kind of trickled out bit by bit. You know, and I feel like if they're going to pull something more out of it, they probably need to go ahead and get to it. If they're going to, you know, make any major indictments, you know, it's probably time.
Right. also the DOJ could act, has not. Big question.
Sure.
Tim, you've been clear about who you'd like to see leave your party. I'm curious about the voices of the future. Who do you think will be driving your party's message ahead of this year's midterms?
It's hard to say. I mean, Mitch McConnell, I think, has done a good job by, he basically kept his mouth shut about Donald Trump for 4 years and now on to 6 years. And so he's a guy who's sort of done his job well. And the problem with the GOP is that so many of the people who kind of suck their neck out as anti-Trump people, some of whom I think have really bad ideas. They tend to be the more hawkish. Adam Kinzinger was a congressman from Illinois, and he seems to want us to go into World War III. I always can point out the problems. I can't always find good solutions. So that's my sad answer. I right now don't see a great Republican leader, because the more anti-Trump people I've seen are not people who I particularly trust.
Alas, we're going to have to leave it there. I wish we had some sort of cause for hope and optimism on all these topics, but we are reflecting our reality right now. We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, I hear you want a more positive question posed to you these days. So what's making you happy these days?
I always have I have a hard time generating rants because I'm usually in a pretty good mood. This week I'm having a really good one with my kids. They're turning really fun ages. They're turning 6 and 3 this summer. So they're just old enough to develop expectations about what's about to happen. The summer ahead's really big for them. We have one going into summer camp to learn how to swim, and we're taking both to Disney World. Both of those experiences will probably be a little bumpy, but right now they're really psyched, and I'm having fun just getting excited with them.
Sounds great, actually. Tim Carney, what's your positive or negative rant?
I could go on about the New York Mets being in first place, but I think we've had enough positivity for the day. President Biden's Department of Homeland Security has just launched its Disinformation Governance Board to counter information threats in the homeland. This is just the latest of the Democrats' unhealthy obsession with the idea of disinformation, an idea grounded in denial and reeking of censorship. Disinformation used to mean something, but now it increasingly just means anything that hurts Democrats. Since the 2020 elections, we've heard so many commentators blame Dems' falling share among Hispanic voters on disinformation in Spanish-language media, as if only dirty lies could drive Latino voters to the GOP. And the woman heading Biden's disinformation board, Nina Jankowicz, has stated her fear of free speech absolutists. That's her quote. In 2020, she suggested that reporting on Hunter Biden's shady foreign influence peddling businesses was, quote, Russian disinformation. It's all an effort to avoid accountability for Democrats' political malpractice and some Democrats' corruption. And also sounds like an effort to brand conservative journalism and commentary as too dangerous to tolerate.
My rant is about the viral meme, I Don't Dream of Labor. It is a saying members of Gen Z are using on TikTok, along with messages like, I don't have goals, I don't have ambition, I only want to be attractive. It's meant to be funny, but also pointed, and you get it's part of the anti-work trend that conveys basically, we can't get security by working, so let's indulge in leisure. Vox wrote a piece on it, then it trended on Twitter. I first became familiar with the saying when I was interviewing a young 20s prospective job candidate to work with me at News Not Noise. I asked her career ambitions as a journalist or creator, and she smiled confidently and said, I don't have an answer to that because I don't dream of labor. I was taken aback, a bit insulted, and impressed in a way. I thought, how could you? And you go, girl, at the same time. I get it. If late teens and 20-somethings are convinced that 9-to-5 work won't deliver them a life they want, they're saying they may as well try to get TikTok famous or relax trying. But as a member of Gen X, I just can't relate. To my fellow Gen Xers, don't you sometimes feel like all we did was labor? Nonstop grind from homework to paying our dues to juggling it all. I kind of celebrate Gen Z for taking a different tack. I'm not sure who's going to solve all the challenges we're leaving them, from climate to polarization. If no one's doing the work, someone's got to do the work. And yes, I know these are generalizations. But for now, I'm wondering, is it too late for the rest of us to stop dreaming of labor? That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Tim Carney, Elizabeth Brunig, and Jonathan Haidt. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Katie Gilchrist and Matt Schwartz, while two of our usual engineers settle into their lives as stellar new dads. Congratulations to Desmond Taylor and Nick Lamponi. We have taken note that Desmond has been wearing his civilized yet provocative Left, Right, and Center hat since becoming a dad. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jessica Yellen. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.